kitchen. He flipped on lights and went into the pantry, where he ripped open a box of energy bars and took out two. When he came out of the pantry, she was standing in the kitchen doorway, which actually came as no surprise, because he'd heard her heels tapping against the floor as she approached the kitchen. But he noticed that she'd swapped this morning's heels for a pair of flats. No wonder she'd looked so diminutive while taking in his house, sitting on his sofa, standing close to him while he poured her wine. He wished he hadn't noticed. He held up one of the bars.
Want one?
No, thank you. He tossed the extra onto the island, peeled the wrapper from the other, and put the end of it between his teeth, where he held it as he moved to the fridge and took out a bottle of orange juice. He got a glass from the cabinet and filled it with the juice. When he turned around, she was seated on one of the previously unused counter stools, back straight, knees primly together, even though she was still wearing the pants outfit she'd had on that morning. He sat down on his stool, facing her, and indicated the power bar.
If you change your mind.
She ignored the offer and went straight to the point.
It's the only way to put Eben Clark back in prison and keep him there.
He noshed a bite of his bar.
When I was playing football, I had to memorize playbooks this thick.
He held his hands roughly 6 inches apart.
I have good retention, but let me make sure I've got this straight.
He looked at her hard.
In order to get that Clark creep put away for murder, I'm the one who has to kill Rebecca.
Looking distressed, she said, that's a harsh summation.
You're goddamn right it's harsh.
And unfair.
I couldn't agree more.
He folded his arms on the granite and leaned against the island toward her.
What's your stake in this?
Did you even look at my business card?
The embossed part, not the address I hand wrote on the back.
An Atlanta address and area code. What are you doing in the DA's office here?
As a courtesy, I was loaned a vacant office to work out of temporarily. I work for the Georgia Attorney General. I'm a state prosecutor.
This isn't Georgia. What work are you doing up here?
She gave him a pointed look. He began to chuckle.
Well, you've got your work cut out for you. No, actually, your work is done. You can pack up and go home.
I know it bothers you that Clark is out.
Of course it bothers me. I meant it when I said they should have thrown away the key.
Then why weren't you at the release hearing, waving a banner to that effect?
You want to know why I didn't come? I'll tell you why. Because if I'd been there, that hearing would have turned into a carnival. Admit it, Ms. Lennon. That hearing came and went without any falderal. It was conducted under the radar. Nobody noticed.
There was media.
Really? I didn't see it on TV. It didn't make all those tabloid shows whose lifeblood are scandals and tragedies. It wasn't the cover story of the National Enquirer.
She tugged on one of the strands of hair that brushed her cheek.
All right.
There was some local coverage because the Clarks have a high public profile in Atlanta. But you've made your point.
Thank you.
He resettled in his seat and finished his power bar, which allowed time for the air to clear before he resumed.
It was better for Doug, for everybody, if I stayed away and voiced my opinion of Clark's early release in writing. In any case, nothing I wrote or Doug said mattered, did it? Clark still got out.
She sighed. I think the outcome was decided even before the hearing was convened. I'm guessing, although it will be difficult to prove, that Sid Clark either bribed or blackmailed the judge. Probably a combination of both. Zach drained his glass of juice and carried it over to the sink.
It sucks,
he said, keeping his back to her as he rinsed out the glass.
It truly does, but I won't do it.
He dried his hands before turning back around.
You know, Rebecca wouldn't leave the house, not even to go to a spin class, without being photo-op ready. Hair, makeup, jewelry, the whole shebang. When she crossed out all the sad stuff in that directive, if she had foreseen the indignity of her current condition, I believe she would have said, I would rather die. But even if I based my decision on what I think would be her wish, I would have to engage in another battle with Doug. I don't want to put him through that, especially since he recently lost Mary. And I don't want to put myself through it either. Apart from the personal agony of having to actually say when, the blowback would be more than I'm willing to endure. For a second time.
He ran his hand over his mouth and chin as he gazed down at the hems of his sweatpants that pooled over his bare feet.
I'm sorry.
He raised his head and looked across at her.
I understand your agenda. It's sound. It's just. I would like nothing better than for that rich prick to live out the rest of his days in misery. I hope you succeed.
Eventually, perhaps I will.
When Rebecca dies on her own, he said.
Yes, but what I fear is that eventually we'll come too late.
Why the time crunch?
The court returned Eben Clark's passport. If he were tipped of a pending murder charge, he could hop his father's private jet to anywhere. He could be long gone by tomorrow. By tonight, as we speak.
She paused and reined in the urgency in her voice.
That's why I came to you, hoping you would at least consider taking this alternative measure.
Sorry, he said again. If nailing him is dependent on me ending Rebecca's life, it's not gonna happen. I went through that hell once. I won't put myself through it again.
Elbow on the island, she propped her chin on her fist. Her gaze was non-judgmental, gently prodding, compelling, and damn her, it worked. He began to talk.
As you know, I abdicated to Doug and Mary and cleared out. I thought that would be the end of it for me. Far from it. Rebecca and I, our stormy marriage and divorce, were headlines again. Of course the media never let up. That was to be expected, but fans would approach me too. I couldn't go anywhere, do anything, without being hounded. Even friends too sensitive to bring it up were dying to get the skinny. I could feel their curiosity.
Kate hadn't moved or said anything, but had continued to watch him with intensity. Now she said,
"Could you have been just a tad paranoid?"
"Possibly. Probably. But at the crux of it, Rebecca's circumstances came to define me, not her."
"I see that. I'm sorry."
"It was a disservice to her, too. Anyhow, I couldn't wait for training camp to start. At least that would restore my focus, discipline, routine. I counted on the upcoming season to be a diversion, not only for me, but for everybody else. But the locker room smack began the first day of camp and soon became intolerable. You know how it is."
She gave a faint smile.
"Actually, I don't."
"Nothing's sacred. Barbs, insults, innuendo. Everything's fair game. But I'd hear things like, 'Give me a chance to pull the plug on my ex.' I'd do it in a heartbeat. Oops, no pun intended."
"God, how awful."
"And that was from my teammates, guys who liked me, who were joking. Opposing players were ruthless. I'd hear junk like that on the playing field. They did it to distract me, of course, and it did. Best mind fuck ever. Sorry, but that's what it was."
"It's all right.
You're not prissy."
She gave that half smile again.
"I guess not."
"My game began to slip. I threw 2 interceptions in 1 game. First time in my career for that to happen. After the game, I got into it with the intended receivers, blamed them for the turnovers. Another first in my career. And something I'm ashamed of to this day. Mid-season, I got a back sprain that kept me on the injured list for the next 4 games. Any other time that would have infuriated me, but I secretly looked on that injury as a welcome reprieve. Backup guy did his best, but we had our first losing season since the team had signed me. Fans got angry. Sports writers got snarky. Word came down from the head office for me to get my shit together before next season. But no pressure, right?"
She laughed softly.
"I predicted you'd say that at some point."
"Now you can stop waiting for it."
He turned his head and glanced out the window above the sink.
"It's getting foggy."
"I'll be fine."
"Deputy Dave warned you about driving in fog."
"I'll take it slow."
He turned back and looked at her.
"Or you could bunk here tonight."
Chapter 10. Kate lifted her chin off the prop of her fist and lowered her gaze to the surface of the island. Zach said,
no strings.
She kept her head lowered and didn't say anything. Maybe she had a prissy streak after all, he thought. Or maybe she had a significant other, and he'd been wrong about her feeling the tug of attraction that he was. In either case, he'd plopped the baited line into the water. He waited her out, curious to see if she would bite. She didn't. When at last she spoke, she returned them to the subject. The next season, you were no longer the team's starting quarterback. He wondered how she knew that. It didn't mean she'd followed the team, only that she'd done her homework before making the trip across the state line to inform him that she had the authority and intention of crapping up his life again. He returned to his counter stool and sat down.
Yeah, they picked up a guy from Bama in the draft. That was the beginning of the end of my career. I warmed the bench most of that season. At the end of it, the team let me go. Nobody else was interested. By then, I was 33 years old and had had two bad seasons back to back.
That's when the network hired you.
Yeah, to talk about a game I could no longer play. It became increasingly harder to do commentary without the chip I was carrying on my shoulder coming through my voice.
You entered the drunken disorderly phase,
which was exposed to the world during a Sunday night playoff game. Rival teams, the Super Bowl at stake, huge viewing audience. I showed up to the set drunk. I insulted the makeup artist who tried her best to conceal the dark circles under my eyes. I verbally abused the sound guy who was trying to adjust my mic level so my slurring wouldn't be so obvious. All this before the first commercial break. He gave a rueful huff. They pitched me off the set during the halftime break. That was the end of that. I couldn't even talk about the game anymore.
Do you miss it? It surprised him that she asked.
Playing, you mean? Yes. I started in grade school, so I've spent more years of my life playing than not. Yeah, I miss the game a lot.
The fame?
Not at all.
Honestly? She gave him a punch on his arm. How bad could it have been to be worshipped and adored by thousands?
It definitely had its perks.
He gave her a grin, but it was short-lived. Serious again, he said,
honestly, it was absolutely fantastic. But then fame turned to infamy. I don't want either back, thank you.
You've made that abundantly clear, she said softly. It was on the tip of his tongue to tell her he was sorry for curtailing her purpose. She was seeking justice, and his decision was preventing her from pursuing it. But an apology would be disingenuous, and she would know that and probably would resent it. Instead, he asked,
"What will you do now?"
"As you said, pack up and go home."
"Dave will be sick. He won't be getting you on that zip line."
"He wouldn't be getting me on that zip line in a million years. I have a fear of heights."
"Yet you drove up the mountain road to see me. Twice.
Risks worth taking."
"They didn't pay off for you, though."
"No, I accept that you're not going to change your mind, and I'm out of arguments." Then her expression changed, as though she'd just been struck with a breakthrough thought. "But maybe not. What's your email address?"
"Why?
Why does anyone ask for an email address? I want to send you something. I promise not to share or publicize the address, okay? You can put it in my phone. It's in my bag on the sofa." She slid off the stool. "I need to be going anyway."
"Before it gets foggier."
"Fog doesn't scare me." They returned to the living area, where the fire had burned down to a heap of red embers. She took her cell phone from her bag and handed it to him. He pecked his email address into it and gave it back.
"When can I expect the email?"
"Soon."
"Give me a hint."
"Tonight."
"No, I mean, give me a hint of what the email is about."
"It'll be self-evident. Once you've read it, give me a call. My cell number is on my business card."
"Don't hold out hope that I'll change my mind. I won't."
"I respect your conflict, Zach. I do. It's important to me that you believe that." She stuck out her right hand.
"I believe it."
He clasped her hand and shook it.
"Kate."
She gave him a close-lipped smile, which he returned. then pulled her hand from his. He walked her to the door, opened it, and stepped out onto the porch to check the weather conditions.
The fog isn't too heavy. You should be all right if you take it slow on the curves.
She went down the porch steps. When she reached the bottom, she halted and looked at him over her shoulder.
I lied to you earlier.
Fog does scare you?
It wasn't my roommate who had your poster above her bed. Catherine Cartwright Lennon played Dirty Pool. The intention of that exit line had been to leave him with something to think about. But if she thought he was going to follow up on it, boy, was she wrong. Did she think flirting would bend his will? She'd have to do better than that. Team groupies used to throw him their thong underwear. They had his name tattooed around their nipples. They were sexting him before the word had been coined. Wearing him down by appealing to his ego wouldn't work either. His had been ground to dust years ago. Besides, he was probably reading too much into her teenage crush on that damn poster. They were both way beyond that. Scrounging in his fridge for something for supper, he found a package of deli-sliced roast beef. He built a thick sandwich with plenty of horseradish and took it and his laptop to his favorite chair in front of the hearth. He added logs to the fire and stirred the embers beneath them to get them going, then sat down to eat. He booted up his laptop and opened his email. The one from her was already there. She'd said soon, but she hadn't even had time to get back to town. She'd stopped alongside the road to send it. What could be so damned important? Then he read the email's subject line. Cursing, he angrily closed his laptop. Her half-empty wine glass was where she'd left it on the coffee table. It had a lip gloss imprint of her lower lip on the rim. To look at it fired his imagination and inflated his cock with hope. Vain hope. He tore at his rare roast beef with all the etiquette of a caveman. Once he'd demolished the sandwich and dusted his hands of breadcrumbs, he reopened his laptop. The one line in the body of the email said that he needed to read only the highlighted sections of the attachment. With dread, he opened it. The fire had burned down to embers again by the time he'd read through the specified sections, twice. He didn't send a reply, but he stared at the screen until it went dark. Damn her. Taking his laptop with him, he killed the lights on the first floor, set the alarm, and climbed the stairs. He went into his bathroom and rummaged through the pile of dirty clothes he'd left on the floor when he'd showered. He fished his cell phone from the pocket of his cargo shorts. There was a time when he'd never been without his phone. He'd taken it into the shower, the hot tub, bed, everywhere. That had been before he'd answered it in the Caymans. Now, he carried it only when he thought it might be essential. He held it in his palm and reconsidered, but then thumbed it on, went into his contacts, and placed the call. He was put through a tiresome menu of options, all of which he skipped until he finally connected with a male human being who said, "How can I help you?"
"I need to book a flight."
"You can do that online, sir."
"I'm aware of that, but I don't want to book online. I want you to book it for me, please."
Grudgingly. "Your name?"
"Zach Bridger."
A sustained silence was followed by a guttural laugh. "Are you kidding?"
"No."
"The Zach Bridger?"
"I have a VIP code."
Zach rattled it off.
"I'm not sure it's still valid."
Miracle of miracles, it was. The agent said, "With or without the VIP status, it's my pleasure to help you, Mr. Bridger. Your destination?" He swallowed, swore, and said a prayer in the same breath.
"New Orleans."
Chapter 11. Eben was awakened by a persistent knocking on his bedroom door.
"Jesus!"
He rolled onto his side and opened one eye halfway.
"Later, Frida. I don't want anything."
His father opened the door and popped his head around.
"Not Frida."
Without invitation, he strolled into the spacious room.
"She told me you two arrived at the house at the same time this morning. She to report for work, you to crawl into bed. I understand she assisted you upstairs and saw you safely tucked in.
Apparently Cal and Theo threw you quite a homecoming bash. Eben rolled onto his back, stretched, and bunched his pillow under his head. The clock on the bedside table read 12:04 p.m. His mouth was so dry, his tongue was stuck to the roof of his mouth. As though reading his mind, Sid poured him a glass of water from a carafe and passed it to him. He gulped it down. "Thanks, Dad. God bless Frida." That she'd stripped him naked when she put him to bed didn't surprise him. She'd been his parents' housekeeper since before Eben was born. God knew how old she was. But she still chugged around like a small locomotive. He had her wrapped around his finger. She often addressed him as baby. Sid sat down on the end of the bed and crossed one leg over the other. He picked at a non-existent speck of lint on his trousers. Eben recognized the gesture as his father's most often used delaying tactic. He asked, "So how are they?" "Who?" Eben thought. "Oh, Cal and Theo." Eben had tried to erase that dinner with them from his mind. It had gotten off to a rocky start and had been capped off by Theo's remark about Eben's prison sentence being fair since he'd actually done the deed. They'd parted with a handshake, but there'd been no authentic camaraderie behind it. From the restaurant, Eben had gone to the home of his favorite drug dealer. He didn't know his last name. Simply Simon was how he'd been introduced to Eben before Eben had been old enough to shave. He'd been a regular customer ever since. Besides his father, Simply Simon seemed to be the only person in Atlanta who was genuinely glad to see him. He'd unctuously welcomed him into his palatial home where gold leaf had been trawled onto almost every surface. Throughout the house, lounging about in various stages of sublimity, were dope heads of every stripe, from corporate CEOs to gangbangers. The recreational use of illegal substances was the only common denominator of the demographic. Eben partook of Simon's smorgasbord, even though Simon cautioned him to exercise moderation until he'd been reconditioned to his pre-prison tolerance level. He brought Eben two women for his consideration. One had skin the color of cream, the other's was as rich as a dark roast blend. Rather than choosing, Eben had told Simon he'd have cafe au lait. The young ladies had been equally beautiful, talented, uninhibited, and, it appeared, expensive. Because when Eben left, the money clip his father had given him was empty.
"What are they doing with themselves these days?"
Eben pulled himself out of the recollection of last night's menage and realized that Sid wasn't asking after the two whores. He was still stuck on Cal and Theo. What were they doing these days? Had he asked? Had they told him? Hell, if he could remember. "Cal's married," he said. "Can you believe it? All the pussy he got without even trying, and the dumb schmuck gets married? Do you think I could weasel a Bloody Mary out of Frida?"
"In a minute. There's something we need to discuss."
Eben had sensed that, but he whined, "Can it wait?"
"No, it can't. It's important."
"All right." Eben tossed back the covers. "Hold the thought. I gotta piss." He went into his bathroom and used the toilet, chugged a mini bottle of vodka, then squeezed a dab of toothpaste on his tongue.
"Ah, better,"
he said as he re-entered his bedroom. He took a pair of briefs from his bureau and pulled them on, then sat down on the end of his bed and faced Sid, who had claimed a chair near the window. The afternoon sun found a crack in the blinds, skewered Eben's eyeball, and pierced straight through his skull. With the sun-filled window behind his old man, his face was in silhouette, a calculated juxtaposition that gave him the upper hand during this important chat. Eben knew that tactic, too. He smiled. "So, Dad, I'm all ears."
"Last night after you left, Up brought up something rather..."
"What's happened to him?"
"To Up? What do you mean?"
"He's all, I don't know, jowly, scowly." He made a face imitating Upton's frown.
"He's got a lot on his mind."
"He's always had a lot on his mind. He's different." He leaned back and propped himself on his elbows. "You know what I think? I think he resents me."
"That's ridiculous, Eben. He loves you. You're his godson."
Yeah, but when the incident, as he refers to my being maliciously accused of a crime, when it happened and I was put on trial, he resented being upstaged by my defense attorney.
We retained him on Up's recommendation.
Yes, but he ran the show. I took his advice, not Up's. Up played second fiddle.
Because he isn't a trial lawyer. He doesn't practice criminal law,
Even chuckled. No, but he practices law criminally. Sid wasn't amused.
Nothing came of that Bar Association investigation. Let's get back to the subject, which Up brought to my attention.
Even shrugged and motioned for Sid to proceed. For the next few minutes, Even listened as Sid explained Up's warning about the possibility of future legal entanglements. When he paused for breath, Even said, "See? He's the prophet of doom and gloom. Hasn't he heard of double jeopardy? I have, and I didn't even go to law school." Sid picked at another imaginary speck of lint.
"He didn't predict that you would be charged for the same crime, Even. What he said was this prosecutor could come after you for another."
"Another crime?"
"The same incident, different charge."
"Like what?" Sid cleared his throat.
"At best, manslaughter. At worst, murder."
Even went perfectly still, then bolted off the bed. "I didn't murder anybody. Nobody fucking died. Why are you bothering me with this? I've already gone to prison for something that wasn't my fault."
"I know, son, but Up is of the opinion..."
"I don't give a shit about Up's opinion. He peaked a long time ago. He's old and tired and he looks it. He's..."
"Sit down."
"Making life difficult. Making up..."
"Sit down.
Don't yell at me." But his father did yell, louder than before.
"Sit down and listen to me."
Resentfully, Even plopped back down on the end of the bed. Sid collected himself before resuming in an even voice.
"Your godfather, our trusted advisor, has, for the entirety of your life, sought only our family's best interest in all matters. He has suggested that you keep a low profile, that you remain above reproach and do nothing that incites censure. Your behavior should demonstrate..."
"Demonstrate to who?"
"Anybody. Everybody. You should demonstrate that you've learned a hard lesson about putting yourself in situations that can... go awry."
"She didn't die."
"She didn't live either," Sid snapped.
He took another steadying breath.
"Up cautioned me, and now I'm cautioning you, that your early release might motivate the prosecutor to attempt to persuade the family to take that girl off life support."
"Her old man won't do it. Remember him at the hearing? Not 3 months ago, he swore that he would never pull the plug on her. Tears streaming down his face."
He dragged his fingers down his cheeks.
"Boo-hoo. As long as my daughter has a heartbeat."
"I well remember that emotional scene, Even. You don't need to remind me."
"Then what's got your drawers in such a wad?"
"It's not her father's decision. It's her ex-husband's."
"Oh, right. Bridger. But he adiosed. Washed his hands of it. Didn't come to either my trial or the hearing. Couldn't care less. Besides, I hear that he crashed and burned."
"Up's afraid."
"Up. Up. I've had it up to here with Up."
"There's a new prosecutor on the case. Up is afraid she'll make a run at Zach Bridger."
"And talk him into changing his mind?"
"That's Up's concern, yes. If Bridger is persuaded, and if he chooses to override Doug Pratt's wishes..."
He raised his hands. "The machines are turned off. She dies."
Even flattened his hands against his bare chest.
"They can't blame me for that."
His father picked at that damn invisible lint again. In a voice Even could barely hear, he said,
"A case could be made, Even. It's not without precedent."
His father explained the legal ins and outs as they'd been laid out for him by Upton. As he listened, Even lapsed into a simmering silence. When his father finished, he got up and walked over to Even, laid a hand on his shoulder, and pressed.
"There are many hurdles to jump. 1,000 ifs. Endless debates, moral and legal. Probably nothing will ever come of it. But you needed to know of the threat so you could take care to avoid unwanted attention. A little circumspection would go a long way toward removing the, taint of Rebecca Pratt.
Sure, I understand.
Good. Please behave accordingly.
Sid patted his shoulder.
You'll be here for dinner?
Yeah, I'd counted on it.
Eben smiled up at him.
Let's shoot some stick after.
You're on.
Sid had almost reached the door when Eben halted him.
You said she.
Sid turned.
Pardon?
The prosecutor. You said she.
Yes, a rising star in the AG's office named Catherine Lennon.
Chapter 12. Zach was shown into Rebecca's room by a nurse who said, "You have a few minutes before she's scheduled to be turned." Anxiety had created a lump in his throat that prevented him from speaking. He merely nodded at the nurse and then was left alone. He had expected the room to be dim and hushed, a deathbed scene, but the window shade was all the way up, letting in sunlight to which his eyes had to adjust. The ceiling lights were on full. Heavy metal rock music was coming from a wireless speaker sitting beside a snow globe of Paris on a wall-mounted shelf. The brightness and the music could be thought to be inappropriate, but this was Rebecca's room. She loved the limelight, spotlights, and hard rock. With reluctance, Zach advanced into the room. To his right was a sink. On the counter next to it were several plastic basins of various sizes, a stack of folded towels and washcloths, containers of liquid soap, shampoo, body lotion, nail clippers, lip salve, a hairbrush, a box of adult diapers. Quickly looking away, he took in all the medical apparatus, the monitoring machines with their blinking lights, the IV pole, the seeming miles of tubing that snaked around the bed and up underneath the light blue blanket, on top of which a pair of hands rested. He didn't recognize them as Rebecca's hands. They were curled downward at a severe angle, fingertips almost touching the inside of her wrists. The nails were short, blunt, unvarnished. After seeing the distortion of her hands, he took several deep breaths before he could bring himself to look at Rebecca herself. He gasped.
"Please have a seat, Mr. Bridger."
The doctor's name was Anna Gilbreth. It was printed on the brass placard at the edge of her desk. The number of letters following her name attested to her qualifications to be the administrator of the special care facility. She reminded Zach of his 10th grade English teacher who'd made the class wade through Beowulf, cardigan sweater, reading glasses hanging from a chain around her neck, and, despite her benign features, an authoritative bearing. She began with a subtle admonishment. "I've been here for 2 years, but up till now I haven't had the pleasure of meeting you." He propped his ankle on his opposite knee, then awkwardly lowered his foot to the floor again.
"My first time here."
"Welcome," she said. "May I ask why now?"
"First, I want to thank you for seeing me without an appointment. I came straight from the airport."
"Fortunately for both of us, I had a clear schedule this afternoon. Where did you travel from?"
"Western North Carolina via Atlanta."
"You came quite a distance. What prompted your visit?"
"I wanted to check things out, talk to whoever is in charge of Rebecca's care."
"Then you're in the right office. What's your impression so far?" He shifted in his seat, propped his elbows on the chair's armrests, then removed them.
"Everything's top-notch. The place, the staff. I'd give it high ratings in every category."
"Thank you. Our staff is committed to providing our patients excellent medical care, as well as treating them with the respect and dignity they deserve."
"That commitment shows."
"I'm glad to hear it." After a brief stall, she said, "I'm told you spent some time in Rebecca's room before asking to meet with me." He put his fist to his mouth and gave a dry cough.
"I didn't really come down here to check up on you, Dr. Gilbreth."
The facility has a flawless reputation, which is why the Pratts chose it. I came to get a clearer understanding of Rebecca's condition. I mean, after seeing her, it's obvious that she... What I want is to understand... Hell. Dropping his head forward, he expelled a long whoosh of air. Softly, she asked, "Would you like some water?" He nodded. She got up, took a bottle of water from a small refrigerator, and brought it to him. He wanted to roll the cold bottle across his damp forehead, but he uncapped it and took a swallow. "Thank you." "You're welcome." She touched his shoulder very lightly, very briefly, before resuming her seat behind the desk. "Don't be embarrassed by your distress, Mr. Bridger. The Rebecca you knew was a vibrant young woman. You wouldn't be human if you weren't deeply affected by her present condition."
"Which is what, exactly? I've been told she isn't brain dead, clinically speaking."
"That's right. Her brainstem function is minimal, but enough that she breathes on her own. She's in what we call a PVS, persistent vegetative state. Rebecca suffered a traumatic brain injury. She was deprived of oxygen for a length of time more than sufficient to cause severe cerebral damage and render her unaware and unresponsive. From a medical standpoint, the qualifier that makes her condition persistent is that it's lasted for longer than 12 months.
"It's been 4 years.
Zach plowed his fingers up through his hair and kept them around his head. His scalp was damp from the sweat he'd broken while in Rebecca's room.
"I didn't expect her eyes to be open."
"She has sleep-wake cycles, but even while awake, she has no awareness of or reaction to her surroundings. She has no cognitive function. She doesn't think or respond to any stimuli."
"Nothing?"
"No." She hesitated. "Family members often cling to the hope, the belief that their voice or touch is somehow getting through to their loved one, that they're communicating on some level." Zach lowered his hand from his head and looked at her directly.
"Her father?"
"He comes every day. He and Mrs. Pratt used to alternate, but since she passed, he's missed very few days. He usually comes early in the morning and stays for an hour or so. You missed him today."
"That's a good thing."
She rolled her lips inward, then said, "Mr. Bridger, I'm not going to pretend that I don't know the circumstances of how Rebecca came to be here.
They were well publicized."
"I didn't follow the story as it was unfolding, but when I took over Rebecca's care, my predecessor informed me of the contention that exists between you and Mr. Pratt. And, just so you know, the staff is aflutter because you're in our midst. Within minutes of your arrival, it had spread throughout the building that you had darkened our door."
"I'd hoped to sneak in and out with only you knowing."
"I believe that would have been impossible."
"Yeah, me too. Can you keep a lid on it?"
"I already have. Everyone on staff received a text reminder from me about our privacy policy, which is strictly enforced."
"Thank you. On behalf of Doug and Rebecca, too.
For you to have risked exposure of your visit, there must be a compelling reason for it."
"There is, but I'm not at liberty to discuss it. I will tell you that it's not a financial problem. The tabloid stories are fiction. I haven't gone broke. I'm not living on the street. You don't need to be concerned about any interruption of the payment schedule."
"I wasn't." She moved closer to her desk, narrowing the distance between them. Speaking more softly, she said, "Why did you come, Mr. Bridger? What is it you want to know?" He spread his knees and clasped his hands between them. Head down, he stared at the carpeted space between his shoes.
"When your predecessor filled you in on Rebecca's history, did he give you all of it, or just hit the high points?"
"He hit the high points, but I took it from there. I read all the reports, all the doctor's notes and recommendations, examined every chart." Although he didn't raise his head, he nodded.
"So you know about Rebecca's drug and alcohol abuse, all that?"
"Yes, I know about everything." He did look up at her then. Her expression remained impassive, but she pointed to a file cabinet. Rebecca's medical records, the ones previous to her being admitted here, are locked away. They're for my eyes only. You can depend on my discretion.
That's good. Thank you. If things get crazy again, and they might, I wouldn't want all that exposed and scrutinized, he said, glancing at the file cabinet.
Why do you think things might get crazy again? Are you second-guessing the decision you made 4 years ago?
No. Maybe. I don't know.
She must have sensed his impatience with himself. Take your time. When he felt ready to put his ambiguities into words, he said,
When this happened to Rebecca, I would have hated it like hell for anybody, for a total stranger. There was no love lost between us, believe me. Neither of us left the marriage with a broken heart. But I guess that vow about in sickness and in health subconsciously factored into my decision to take no action. Now, though, I've been given a reason, a crucial reason, to reevaluate. First thing I want to ask is how long can Rebecca remain like this? And please, no bullshit about the brain being a mysterious organ or stranger things have happened or you're not God. Based on all those letters, he said, chinning toward the nameplate, and your history with similar patients, you're qualified to give me your best guess. How long?
She indicated that she understood his request and would give it to him straight. Rebecca hasn't experienced any organ failure. She hasn't contracted pneumonia, and we do all we can to prevent that and other infections, any of which could be fatal. In every regard, she's well cared for. Her bodily functions are closely monitored and seen to. She's exercised daily. She gets adequate fluids and nutrition.
Through tubes?
Yes. He rubbed his forehead.
What you're saying is she could stay like this indefinitely, that nothing will ever change.
On the contrary, she could decline. It could be sudden and steep or gradual. Any of the things that I just told you hadn't happened yet could occur at any time. For instance, the brainstem could cease function, requiring that she be put on a ventilator.
I thought she was. What's that tube for?
He touched his Adam's apple. She can't swallow. The tracheotomy tube prevents obstruction and eases her breathing. He assimilated everything she'd told him.
What you're saying is that things could get worse, but she'll never improve.
Patients who recover from a TBI usually begin showing improvement within a matter of days. After this length of time, she shook her head. In the highly unlikely event that Rebecca became even minimally conscious, her mental capacity would be nil. Her most recent EEG and PET scan show virtually no electrical activity or cerebral function. She gave him a kind smile. But stranger things have happened, and I'm not God. His throat had grown tight, making it difficult to swallow.
Say you were called upon to play God, Dr. Gilbreth. What would you do?
Chapter 13. Zack had to press Bing's doorbell 3 times before he heard the bolt clack. His former coach opened the door.
Where'd you come from?
Louisiana.
What the hell were you doing down there?
It's raining out here.
Bing moved out of the way and motioned him inside. He took off his jacket and shook rainwater off it, then hung it on the hall tree.
Why didn't you answer your doorbell?
Why didn't you warn me that you were coming? If you were on your way home from Louisiana, wasn't coming through South Carolina a little out of your way?
After retiring from his coaching job at Clemson, Bing had moved back to nearby Greenville, where he'd begun his career at a local high school.
Now you're here,
he turned and waved his hand for Zack to follow him. They filed down the dim hallway whose walls served as a gallery for pictures of football teams, players, and highlight game moments captured on film. The images covered the decades of Bing's coaching career. Zack was featured in many of the photos, but he didn't pause to gaze upon them with nostalgia. Bing led him into his den, a room that defined the word. It had darkly paneled walls, a low acoustical tile ceiling, two small windows with shades that Zach had never seen open, and furniture that was at least 30 years old. But a large, late-model, high-tech TV was attached to the wall, opposite Bing's vintage leather recliner.
"It was just getting to the good part," he grumbled.
On the screen, a man and woman, both buck naked, were copulating with vigor in a bed draped in embellished velvet. Zach said,
"Don't let me interrupt."
"Oh, I've seen it."
Bing reached for the remote and muted the lusty grunts and groans.
"It's one of those historical series. There's a bloody war with horses and swords and castles and knights shouting, 'Open the gate!'
Who's winning?
The war? I don't know. I don't think the warriors know, either. They fornicate more than they fight."
He claimed his recliner.
"Sit down. Want something to drink? You know where the fridge is."
There was a can of beer on the TV tray at Bing's right hand.
"No thanks."
Zach sat down on the sofa and leaned his head back against the sagging cushion.
"You gonna make me ask again?"
"I'm not thirsty. I'll get something later."
"Not about that. What were you doing in Louisiana?"
"Where in Louisiana?"
"New Orleans."
"Huh." They exchanged a long look, communicating silently what his trip had pertained to. Bing took a sip of his beer, then returned the can to the tray, saying,
"Well, you've got the right to know where things stand with her."
"The right?"
Zach laid his forearm across his eyes.
"I'd happily give up that right. I tried to."
"Not hard enough."
"I did what I thought was right at the time."
"You caved under pressure is what you did, like a rookie."
"Jesus, you're making me sorry I came."
"Why didn't you insist on resigning, Zach? You would have been free of this years ago."
"That was then, this is now. Let's focus on now, okay?"
Bing was scowling, but he eased off.
"Did you see Rebecca?"
"Yes."
"Bad, I guess."
"You guessed right."
"Was her dad around?"
"No."
"Any particular reason why you chose now to pay a visit?"
"Yes."
Zach lowered his arm and looked over at Bing, who had his rough hands linked and resting on his middle. He'd settled in to listen.
"Yesterday morning, I was outside having coffee and enjoying my view of the waterfall. This slick SUV pulls up."
Zach began at the beginning and told him everything. When he finished, having talked for almost half an hour uninterrupted, he kept his eyes closed and waited to hear what Bing would say about it all.
"So this Lennon woman gave you the transcript of Eben Clark's trial?"
"Last night."
Last night? God, it seemed like 1,000 years ago. And he'd covered at least that many miles since then.
"She sent it to me in an email."
"And you read the parts she'd highlighted?"
"Twice."
"When did you last sleep?"
Zach opened his eyes.
"What?"
"You heard me."
"She left my house about, I don't know, after reading the transcript. I booked my flight, packed, and drove to Atlanta. Left my car in a remote lot at the airport and slept for a few hours at one of the hotels there."
Bing said,
"Then took an early flight to New Orleans, went to the hospital, and had your meeting, then back to the airport for a return flight to Atlanta."
"Picked up my car and drove here,"
Zach said testily,
"which I'm beginning to regret. I came to you for advice, and you're talking like a damn travel agent. What am I supposed to do, Bing?"
Unfazed, Bing said, "Well,
first thing I advise is that you get some rest. You're too exhausted to think through a dilemma like this. Have you eaten?"
He waved that off.
"Miss Lennon is afraid that Clark will get word of what she's after and take off to parts unknown, in which case she'll have lost her shot."
"How determined is she?"
"I think she's made it a mission, but she hasn't told me why."
"It's her job."
"Yeah, but I get the sense there's a personal slant."
He only realized as he spoke the words that he had sensed that about Kate. Her packaging was petite, but she had a crusader's persistence.
"Is she a man-hater?"
Bing said.
"Blames us all for the sins of a few?"
"No, she's not like that."
"What is she like?"
He had hoped Bing wouldn't ask, but now that he had, he hedged.
All business. Articulate. Smart. She's doing this covertly. Says her success depends on secrecy. First wind of it, and Clark would take to the skies, which is why she wants my decision sooner rather than later.
Then tell her later. For Christ's sake, Zach, this is a decision nobody should ever have to make. Tell this Lennon woman to back off. Give yourself a day or two.
I would, but in a day or two, the dilemma I'm faced with could be the hot topic on every TV talk show. Dr. Gilbreth said her staff was all a flutter over me being there. She reminded them of the strict privacy policy, but I was relieved as I left the building not to see news vans parked outside. I'm certain Doug will learn that I was there. He'll go apeshit.
He lowered his head and rubbed his gritty eyes.
I admire the guy, Bing. I was in that room for 5 minutes at the most. When I came out, I was weak in the knees. Came close to losing it in Dr. Gilbreth's office. I expected it to be awful, but it was worse than awful. Much worse. Doug lives with it day in, day out. He's hands-on. Rebecca's fate should lie with him, not me. We could have guardianship switched over to him, but could we do it secretly? I doubt it. That's the hitch. The gossip mongers would be clamoring to know why now. That might get Clark's antenna up and blow any chance Ms. Lennon has of getting another indictment. Besides that, I wouldn't want the publicity for Doug or me. The rumors and speculations circulating all over again? No thank you. What if someone at the facility was low enough to leak pictures of Rebecca to the media? God, I can't bear the thought. Dr. Gilbreth has faith in her staff's commitment to the patients and their privacy, but I'm afraid it would go right out the window if enough money was offered.
Zach noticed that Bing hadn't chimed in for a while. He was tugging on his lower lip, seemingly deep in thought.
Are you listening? Zach asked. Yes, and I'm paying attention. I'm just thinking about all the lives that continue to be wrecked because of that Clark shithead. I'd love to see that Lennon woman come through.
Zach hadn't yet forgiven Kate for sending him the trial transcript, although he'd learned a lot from reading it. She had highlighted the prosecutor's opening statement and closing argument. She'd highlighted the defense attorney's fiery rebuttal. Also highlighted were the testimonies of Calvin Parsons and Theo Simpson, who'd steadfastly denied that Rebecca had been a victim. She'd also highlighted the testimonies of the doctors who saw Rebecca when she arrived at Emory's ER, as well as the testimonies of specialists who assessed her condition after they brought her out of the coma. He said to Bing now,
"The trial transcript didn't make for light reading."
"I'm sure it didn't, but it spurred you to drop everything, come down from your mountain hideaway, and go see for yourself the damage that degenerate did to Rebecca."
"What are you getting at?"
"Like the Lennon woman says, Clark will remain free unless you..."
"Bing, I can't. Whenever I heard of taking someone off life support, I thought of turning off a ventilator. It's horrendous even to think about flipping that switch. But at least it's over in a matter of minutes. Less. Rebecca isn't on a ventilator. Do you know what I would have to authorize? Removal of the feeding tube. No more fluids."
Zach leaned forward, propped his elbows on his knees, and covered his face with both hands.
"It could take days. Is it any wonder that Doug is so opposed to it? Who could bring themselves to do that? I just can't."
Bing sat quietly, then picked up the remote and turned off the TV where medieval war was still raging. He lowered the footrest and came out of his recliner.
"There hasn't been anyone in the extra bedroom since you were last here. Sheets probably smell mildewy."
The thought of a bed was alluring, but Zach was so exhausted he couldn't bring himself to move from his spot on the sofa. He pulled an ugly knitted afghan from the back of it and grabbed a throw pillow.
"I'll do fine right here. Suit yourself."
At the door, Bing stopped and turned back.
"Maybe you ought to flip your thinking."
"What do you mean?"
"Well, it occurs to me that you've given a lot of thought
to how your decision, whichever way it goes, will affect Ms. Lennon and her cause, that Clark deviant, Doug Pratt, and yourself. But have you given any thought to the person most affected by your decision? Rebecca. Chapter 14.
Zach was up before Bing, up before he wanted to be, but he'd awakened early and knew he wouldn't go back to sleep. He wrote Bing a note of thanks for his wise counsel and for putting him up for the night, and promised to be in touch soon. He left the note on the kitchen table under the salt shaker and sneaked out before daylight. Although there was no sunrise to see, the sky was overcast and glowering. The drive from Bing's house in Greenville, South Carolina, to Zach's place took 5 hours. He drove it as the crow flies, keeping to the narrow state highways. Even then, it wasn't a straight shot. The roads were twisty and, today, kept slick by intermittent rain. When he finally pulled into his cul-de-sac, his body was stiff from sitting for so long, and his mind ached from thinking. To work the kinks out of both, he spent half an hour in his home gym, showered, then crawled into bed and took a nap. When his alarm went off, he dressed and drove into town. He was relieved to see the familiar SUV parked parallel in front of the ugly office building. He pulled his pickup into a metered slot facing the courthouse. When Kate exited the DA's office at 6:20, he got out of his truck, jogged across the street, and reached the driver's side of her car ahead of her by a margin of 5 seconds. She drew up to her full height and said with accusatory pique, "I called you several times yesterday."
"I know. I ignored the calls because I hadn't decided yet if I was still speaking to you."
"Since you're here, I guess you are." She hoisted her weighted bag more securely onto her shoulder, like a soldier preparing for an uphill charge.
"What did you come to say?"
"That place that grills trout to perfection?"
Obviously, that hadn't been what she'd expected, and it took her a moment to respond. "The lodge."
"They grill a good steak, too. Are you hungry?"
She kept him waiting while she mulled it over, then said, "I suppose I could eat, after a glass of wine."
"That kind of day?"
"And then some."
"I'll meet you there."
He left her standing beside her car and walked back to his pickup. He didn't want it to appear that this was a date. He hadn't shaved his scruff, hadn't dressed for a date. He was in his favorite worn jeans, an old pair of boots, and a leather jacket over a lightweight sweater. He got spattered with raindrops as he made his way from his truck to the entrance of the restaurant, where he waited for Kate, watching as she got out of her car and popped open an umbrella. She was the type who'd have one at the ready. He held the door open and ushered her inside. The hostess greeted them with a down-home smile.
"Hi, Zach."
And to Kate she said,
"You were here last week. I like your hair. Welcome back. I didn't know y'all knew each other. Want a window table or one near the fireplace?"
Zach deferred to Kate, who gave a little shiver.
"Fireplace, please."
When they were seated in a cozy booth adjacent to the hearth, the hostess took their drink orders, then left them with menus. Kate, busy with placing her napkin in her lap, said,
"You must come here often." "When I run out of things I know how to cook."
"I thought you might have someone who cooks for you."
"Why would you think that?"
She slapped her menu onto the table. "I don't know, Zach. Actually, I never gave a thought as to whether or not you had a personal chef. It was just something to say to end an awkward silence."
"Was it awkward for you?"
She glared at him and was on the verge of saying something when the hostess arrived with their drinks. Zach told her they'd signal when they were ready to order. Kate waited until she was out of earshot.
"I guess you were too miffed to speak to me because of what I'd emailed you. You blindsided me. A blindside hit is always the hardest."
"Did you read any of it?"
"Yes."
"And?"
"We'll get to that."
He clinked his glass of bourbon against her wine balloon.
"Cheers."
"Not really."
Nevertheless, she took a drink of her wine. "What made your day rotten?"
"A culmination of things.
I had to walk to and from the courthouse a dozen times and...
Why?
Because the internet connection is better there. According to the lady at the cable office who took my complaint call, the internet service is especially dicey when it's wet outside.
It is.
How was I supposed to know that? I don't live up here in the mountains. I should have been cautioned about the internet's unreliability before they stuck me in the horrible office. Anyway, I spent all day traipsing back and forth across the street, and now I look and feel like a drowned rat, while you show up looking like a Ralph Lauren ad, which amounts to sabotage and is very unfair. Just saying. She took another slug of wine. Zach wanted to laugh, but he wasn't that stupid.
You could have saved yourself all this hassle by going back to Atlanta.
I didn't want to drive through the mountains in the rain. Besides, I thought I'd stay until I got your reaction to the transcript of Evan Clark's trial. He wanted her simmered down before they talked about that.
What else got you riled?
She hesitated, stared into the low flames in the nearby grate, then brought her gaze back to him. I have an investigation.